We're talking now with Sage Dixon. He's our senior member of our legislative contingent in District 1. He is actually the assistant majority leader in the House of Representatives. He also sits on the Revenue and Tax Committee, the Business Committee, and the Transportation Committee. So you have a full slate there, Sage.
I do. And boy, that what an auspicious title to be the senior member now.
It's scary, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. You're back fresh from Boise now. Yes. Take just a minute or two and tell us how you felt the session went.
Okay. It went really well, Chris. I mean, there's always, well, there were some bumps, I'll say that. But for half the legislature being new, it went well, I think. And there was kind of an interesting flip in the way the bodies were acting, meaning that the Senate became a little more conservative and the House became a little more moderate. So there were some interesting dynamics that came with that. But overall, I think we as a leadership team in the House felt it was a really good session and working out some of the kinks with new folks. And there was a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So they kind of had their own idea of the way things should go. And we were trying to help them learn.
Yeah. Well, I will say from up here, it looked like it was a very eventful session.
Yes.
Eventful being however you want to interpret that. Right.
In the leadership position, it's more management. So you and I spoke of earlier, not really in the trenches day to day. So yep. I'm having to think about those events, but you're correct. It was pretty eventful when you step back and look at it.
Well, we're going to go through a series of bills that were considered. Most of them passed. A couple of them didn't pass, but we wanted to see where you stood on each of these. And we're going to be squeezed for time. So we're trying to spend just a 2 or 3 minutes with each one. I know that's difficult because each one of these could merit a whole half hour conversation in and of themselves. But let's start out with one of the most significant bills to pass, I think, for the average resident here is House Bill 292, which is a bill that set property tax cuts and had some legislation related to school bonds. There were several bills that came up that were trying to take on property taxes for residents. And this particular bill had a kind of a rider on it that will also eliminate March dates for school bond and levy elections. Now, Governor Brad Little vetoed the bill. The legislature, however, overrode his veto and approved a trailer bill to address some of his concerns. So you voted aye on both for the original bill as well as to override. The argument that I observed from up here was that this bill was pretty complicated, could have been simpler, and it's not indexed to inflation or the consumer price index as some other proposals were. So tell us how you stood on this one.
This was very important to almost everybody in the legislature. I think everybody would say it was important to them to get some definitive property tax relief. Last year, what we passed for property tax relief was more about controlling budgets, and so that works itself out more in the future. We didn't see it directly on our property tax receipts or when we got it there, and we were all very interested in doing something that would affect the property owners immediately in doing that. Long conversation. It started before the session started. There was a senator who wanted to just knock $300 or $400 off the homeowner's property tax bill. In the House, there were two other proposals. One had to do with an indexing of the homeowner's exemption, essentially. And another one was a larger proposal that looks very similar to what 292 ended up being in, taking different pots of money and really trying to get to controlling that bond and levy issue that is always so contentious, no matter where you go. And a lot of times they're not failing. I mean, passing right now also, they're failing at the ballot. So we were trying to address a lot of those. And that one was more comprehensive. The best way to do these things is to get them out there where all the legislators can see them and the public can see them and really filter through the ideas. So in House Revenue and Taxation, we brought all three of those proposals forward, and then the parties started talking together, worked itself out closer to the end of the session into what 292 was. It took a lot of counsel and agreements and consolidation, that's not right, but cooperation. Concession, there's the word I was thinking on each
compromise,
side.
Maybe.
Compromise,
yeah.
Too, yes, yeah. Thank you, all these C words. Yeah. To get to this point, right to the end. And so it is a very complicated bill still because it pulls money from different revenue streams from the surplus that we had to take care of it right now. And it basically does four things that you mentioned. Primarily, it's going to be 3/4 of that tax relief will go to homeowners primarily.
And that's a big chunk, $200 million or more.
Right. And it should roughly, I was trying to get a definitive number figure, but it'll depend on what your taxing districts are, but it could be between $300 to $500 per homeowner, that that'll come off their property tax rolls. The House felt strongly that everybody that's a property tax owner should get some relief, meaning ag and timber and commercial. And so that comes in also. But in this package, that's only about a quarter of it. So it is a large package. Then we still wanted to address that bond and levy issue. So there's ongoing dollars that will go to school districts based upon the average daily attendance distribution that we do to fund them anyway, where they will get that. I thought it was only $100 million a year. You said $200. I'd have to check. But I thought it was $100 million a year will be distributed to every school district to help relieve their current bond requirement right now. If they don't have a bond requirement, then it has to go to levies. And if it doesn't have a levy, then it is to be put into an account for future building projects. So trying to remove that need to go out to the taxpayers of a district to continually fund the schools, trying to get more money, even though we put a large sum of money into education this year. That's the goal of that, one facet of that. We did increase the circuit breaker, because when we went and did tax reform in 21 or 22, it pulled a lot of our seniors and fixed income people off that circuit breaker. So we increased that cap to put them back on. Mm-hmm. I received a lot of phone calls in our area about that. So that was a good part of it. And then finally, what you said about removing that March election date. Now, ever since I've been in the legislature, we've been trying to consolidate our elections, both the municipal and county elections and then the school district elections. And this, we had an effort this year that passed out of the House to remove both of them. Wasn't going to go anywhere in the Senate, but they put it into this, and it got passed. And I know that was kind of a point of contention for the governor, as well as the complexity of it. But I think it's a good bill. Ideally, when we're giving that money, I mean, the thought behind it is we're giving money directly to the school districts to address those needs that they would be levying for. So why do we need those additional levy dates in doing that? August is still there for now. Hopefully this is going to take care of it all.
Well, March is the date that they have the most success in passing levies. And I'll mention, I know in Boundary County, I just read a story about some of the facility problems they're having up there. This bill doesn't really get into facilities per se. So that's, I assume there's going to be some reckoning at the legislature at some point about how we're going to help our schools.
Well, those dollars
facilities.
That they get from this will go apply directly to the facilities. I mean, that's their first stop to
replace the school, or they can use it any way they want, right?
There's three ways. It has to be to service the bond, then to service a levy, and then they can save it for building projects, which also, I'll say, they can bond against through a municipal bond program. So they're not doing an election bond. They can put it out there on the financial market with the backing of the state going to be continuing to fund this. So that helps them get those dollars for those larger projects without having to put it on the back of the taxpayer.
Okay. Well, we got a lot to go through. We just ate up. And each one of these, again, could be a half hour.
There are. These are big ones. It's good. And that's complicated. Good to explain that
particular one is. Okay. Next up, let's talk about House Bill 314, which has to do with library materials. It would have allowed parents to sue schools or libraries if they disseminated harmful materials to minors, which harmful materials definition could include nudity, sexual conduct, sexual excitement, among other things. Successful lawsuits could claim $2,500 in damages for each instance. This did pass the legislature, but was vetoed by the governor. An attempt to override the veto failed in the House by one vote to achieve the two-thirds required. Sage, you voted aye on the bill and on the override, I believe.
Right, correct.
And the argument on this one against that position would be, well, this, doesn't this infringe on freedom of speech and thought, and shouldn't parents simply control what their own children are checking out?
Right. I agree with parents should control that, but unfortunately many don't. They'll just drop them off there. I don't see any problem with protecting minors and our role as the state from these materials that are truly harmful. I don't see how it's a freedom of speech issue in keeping somebody who, any other individual or entity cannot give these materials to children or have them available for children, but for some reason we have the exclusion for schools and libraries. So I think it's appropriate to install those prohibitions. This wasn't banning books. It wasn't saying they were removed from the libraries. They just had to be in an area that was exclusive to adults and not minors. There was some argument that this would harm intellectual development, and I had a large problem with that because these are salacious materials designed to affect children in a certain way, to overly sexualize children that are out there. And there were a lot that were brought before the committees that dealt with this.
Saw examples of what you considered salacious materials.
Yes, there were folks from our district and other districts emailing portions of books, not photos or anything.
Books that are on the library shelves?
As far as I know. Okay. I can't. This was one of those things I wasn't deeply involved with, but philosophically I agree with in doing that and knowing that there's a problem in that. And if it's not there, Chris, my point is still that's great, then we still want to protect against it for anything that may happen in the future. And that's why I don't really understand that argument. Well, we don't have it, so leave us alone. Well, we still want to protect against it. Even if you don't have it now, let's make sure it never happens in that issue. So I don't agree with a lot of those arguments in doing that. I do agree parents should take more responsibility for their children, absolutely. But I didn't think this was an overstep by the legislature. I think it's a protective measure to maintain children's innocence.
Okay. Next bill we want to talk about is House Bill 339. This was actually an advisory question. Would have been placed on the 2024 general election ballot, asking voters whether they support using public funds for private schools. It failed in the House, and I believe you voted against it.
Correct.
The argument would be here, I guess, wouldn't it be helpful to know what your constituents feel about on this issue?
Advisory votes mean absolutely nothing. They're not binding in any way. And this was a pretty contentious issue once it started going, and especially in the House, that being school choice and what that should look like in Idaho. And the House committee was becoming pretty calcified in its position, and then the rest of the body was interested in seeing something move. And so my big point with this not being anything that's binding, it's just going to be used as a political lever. One side is going to say, look, everybody wants it, or the other side is going to say, no, nobody wants it. And that doesn't help with the deliberation that the legislature needs to go through in order to reach a conclusion. Because we all can pull statistics from wherever we want to kind of try and prove our point, but then that leaves us at an impasse when there needs to be something decided. And there was something decided essentially by our House committee. They weren't really hearing anything that was going in the way of school choice. And so I'm in favor of that. That was a little frustrating for me, but nonetheless, that's the way that committee was populated, and those people were voted to bring that perspective. I'm assuming they all said they weren't in favor of that when they were elected in doing that. So that's why I saw that as a bad idea, Chris, mainly because it would just be something that was going to be a political hammer on one side or the other and not really help solve that issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to the next contentious bill. That's Bill 242. Has to do with transporting minors for abortions. This one got an awful lot of press around the state, I think. Mm-hmm. It criminalizes transporting a pregnant minor who's seeking an abortion out of state or providing a pregnant minor with an abortion-inducing drug without parental knowledge.
Correct.
That's an important part of it, I think. It has a penalty of 2 to 5 years in prison. This was approved, and the governor signed the bill into law. You favored it. I guess the argument against it would be, isn't this government overreach into the private decisions of families?
Families could make those decisions, even though we have outlawed abortion essentially within the state. If a family made that decision, that is included in this, being the parents. And if it's an uncle, then no, because there's a lot of people, I think, that would be willing to help a minor, if either for nefarious purposes or because they thought they were truly helping, to go and have access to something that we within the state they said they shouldn't have access to. So it was protecting that portion of the law that we created here and making sure that things were done, strengthening the family's knowledge actually and what the family wants to decide, rather than people outside doing what they thought was right with that minor and taking them across a state line. So I saw it as actually protecting parental rights, not decreasing parental mm-hmm. rights.
Okay. Next bill we want to talk about is House Bill 374. It clarifies that medical treatment for miscarriages and ectopic pregnancies are allowable under the state's abortion ban. This was approved. The governor signed it into law. You voted aye on it. I think the argument here would be for those who oppose abortion that they believe all abortions should be prohibited. At least some of those do, even when it puts the mother's life in jeopardy. Why did you vote on Why did you vote as you did on this one?
So there needed to be some clarification, and especially for the medical industry. The Idaho Medical Association was very against that, and I don't know if it, whatever the reasons were, that was a lot of the negotiation and a little bit of what happened here with what Bonner County was saying, or Bonner General, why they would no longer be doing OBGYN things. The Supreme Court's ruling made it clear to a lot of us, but still that was the effort here, is to try and walk that fine line of not creeping into something where a mother's health is her mental health or financial health. And those are things very concerning to us that are pro-life, of that not being allowed, you know, to murder a child in that sense. But this just clarifies that an ectopic pregnancy is not a viable pregnancy. You're not terminating a life at that point. And miscarriages are miscarriages. They're very clear, different situations, because it's not a viable child or fetus, whatever term we want to use there, in doing that. So this
and there is some question right now that health providers feel like,
right, they, and I'm not intimately in those conversations. I'm trying to learn more just so I'm better versed at it, so I can have conversations like this. But that intent was to try and clarify that, to give them a little more clear guidance that they would not be abridging the law if they were to handle an ectopic pregnancy, that nobody could come sue them in that sense. And I imagine that helps, insurance gets involved in these things also in that sense. But that's why I thought that was a good bill, Chris, because it clarified it and should make it easier for the medical professionals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next bill we want to talk about, House Bill 71, having to do with gender-affirming care. This one will make it a felony to provide trans children with gender-affirming medical care. Providers will be barred from giving minors hormones, puberty blockers, or transition-related surgeries. This one passed, and the governor signed this one into law. I'd say there was probably more general agreement that a permanent procedure such as surgery should not occur until a child becomes an adult, but this law will deny other types of care to children who are experiencing gender dysphoria, and in many cases they're suffering to the extent that they become suicidal. So I guess this would also be another question, is this government overreach into the private decisions of families?
Very complicated topic, and I know there's a lot of parents that feel that they're doing the right thing for their child in that pressure. This is a modern phenomenon, meaning even within the last 5 years, that it seems to be more of a social issue than it is an actual mental issue, in the way it was handled before, where children were counseled and eventually they grew out of a lot of these things. And that was a lot of my concern, is are we allowing something to happen, even though a parent is well-meaning, not having all the information? Most of the medical industry isn't pushing back on this and giving any other counsel. We spoke to a young lady who's going around nationally about her experiences, where the medical industry didn't encourage her or force on her, but they didn't say, maybe you want to stop and think about this. It was, this is the way you feel, let's go. And she's very regretful, and I think there's stories more and more out there you're hearing about that. So trying to protect that child again when they're small, and if it's still something that they want to make a decision as when they're considered an adult, then that's unfortunate in my opinion, but that's something that they're going to be doing as an adult. So I guess you could see it maybe a little bit creeping into parental rights there, but at the same time trying to offer protection when it seems like our culture is rushing in a direction that eventually it will rush back from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about the next bill here, House Bill 124. I'm going to actually put these two kind of together.
Okay.
House Bill 124 eliminated the ability of a student to use their student ID card to vote. That one got signed into law. As well as there's a second bill called the Free Voter ID Bill 340. It directs the Idaho Department of Transportation to issue no-cost ID cards for the purpose of voting. The governor also signed that one into law. You voted aye on both of these. So I guess one bill made it a little harder for people to vote. The other one makes it maybe easier. Tell us how you stood on those.
It's a big problem in the Moscow area with the U of I, from what residents down there have said, with out-of-state people voting with the student ID. So we're trying to tighten up our voting rules in that sense. But at the same time, if somebody is a legitimate resident and doesn't have an ID, then they can go apply and get this card, because that's the other side of the argument of trying to not restrict voting and doing that. So I saw both of them as very plausible and not something that was restricting. if you don't live here, you shouldn't be able to vote in Idaho elections. And if you're a student traveling from out of state, unless you've established residency, which would mean you'd have a Idaho identification card, a driver's license or something, then that's fine, go vote. But not just with a student ID that says you're going to school in Idaho when you may not be a resident. Then the other one being, if somebody's unable to have a driver's license, then they can still get a verified ID card or a voter card that says they're a resident, so mm-hmm. they can go vote.
Yeah,
so I thought it was upholding.
At no cost, too.
Right,
so.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Let's push on to the next one. This one has to do with
You're
voting as well.
Testing my memory here.
Absentee voting, House Bill 205, would have made it more difficult for voters to qualify for absentee voting. To receive a mail-in ballot, right. voters must have either been in the military, had a disability, had an illness. There were some specific ways they could receive a absentee ballot, but a lot of people would not have been eligible to do an absentee ballot anymore. This one failed in the House, but you voted yes for it. And I'd say, you know, the argument in favor of absentee voting is simply it's a big assist to our local voters, and a good decent percentage of them here do vote absentee. So, you know, explain your vote on this one, Sage Dixon.
Right, on the spot now. I wrestle with this a little bit because I know it is a benefit to many, many people, but I think it should be a bit more restricted in the sense that you really should not be able to go to the poll, not that you're just doing it out of convenience. Because I'm concerned with it, if we become too flippant in our voting, then it just doesn't give the right result and people are too open to misinformation when it's coming through. It's a philosophical thing with me, Chris. I want as many people as possible to come, but I think it is important to go to the polls also, and it becomes a larger community event, and it rises the impact or our perception of what voting should be and is. When you look at countries that are voting for the first time and how important it is to them and huge, I think we've lost that a little bit here. And when it's just easy to get something at home and fill it out and kind of ship it off, I think that lessens that, and then it lessens the whole and pardon me, my vocabulary is suffering today, but just the way we look at our government and that our system of government, we start to take it for granted a little bit. So this wasn't constructed very well. I admit that. I don't like some of those exclusions. There should have been more, and some of them seem a little bit superfluous. But I do think you should have a darn good reason why you can't go to the polls. And if you're homebound, that's an obvious reason. And a lot of seniors have a hard time getting out. And to me, that's fine. But if it's just out of convenience, that's where I have trouble with that and think that we should show up at the polls. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful that people want to vote, but I do think it should be something more special than it's become.
I guess the question would be, you know, what happens if they're going to be out of town on election day?
Well, I think that's legitimate also.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We're going to be traveling this next election day, and so we'll get ours.
Yeah. Had an illness, job, or class that prevented them from voting in person. So I suppose there may have been some exceptions in there. But anyways, that one didn't proceed. So it failed, and it might come up again next year.
It may. Yeah. I think a lot of people looked at what those exemptions were and thought this didn't make sense. I mean, to say a religious mission for this group and not somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so I think that language needs to be tightened up a little bit, and maybe it will come back.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next bill we want to talk about. This is actually Senate Joint Resolution 101, so this originated in the Senate, but it would have amended the Idaho Constitution to require 6% of voters in each of the Idaho's 35 legislative districts to sign a petition in order to get a citizen initiative on the ballot. This one would have required two-thirds approval from both the House and the Senate to get on the ballot, and then citizens would have had to vote for it, because it's actually a constitutional amendment that's being proposed here. This particular bill was adopted by the Senate, but it failed in the House. You voted for it in the House. I guess the argument here is, you know, the right for citizen and initiative and referendums in Idaho, it's part of the Constitution. It's already really difficult for citizens to do a successful initiative, and this would make it the proponents, at least, say it would make it so difficult as to be almost impossible. And it would give one single district among the 35 legislative districts basically veto power over the other 34. What did you feel were the arguments in favor of this?
Well, I have felt that if we have this process, and I I think you know, and others in our district know, that I don't like this process. If we have to have this initiative process, then it should look as much like the legislative process as we possibly can. So to be able to go to three or four counties and get the signatures you need to put on the ballot, and then the fact that at that point it's just a matter of how many dollars you can pump into a media campaign, from what I've seen in this modern age, and yes, it hasn't been used that way necessarily the few times, well, I think it's in the 30s now, times it's been used since this was put into the Constitution. The game has changed now. There's signature gathering companies where you give them $1 million and they'll get all your signatures because they can data mine and target people exactly. They know exactly where to go. I don't think this would have changed it one bit, because they'll be able to find 6% of the registered voters wherever they go because of that data mining possibility. That's why I thought it was a good idea. I was surprised it didn't pass the House myself. I know the sponsor did a lot of work in the Senate, and I thought it was going to be a lot closer than it was, but I still thought it was going to pass in the House, because we have passed things like this for the past 4 years, really, if not more, maybe 6 years, that we tried that 5 or 6 years ago to restructure how it was done to make it a little more reflective of the legislative process. But that's why I voted for it, Chris, because I just don't like that process.
Okay, well, right now you do have to get 6% in 18 of the 35 legislative districts, as the law currently stands. So Reclaim Idaho, of course, is the biggest example we have. They had a successful initiative, 4 years ago now, or 5 years ago?
It was five, right? Because we just revisited it.
But there's only been a couple in the past decade, probably, that have been successfully gotten on the ballot. And those folks that are in favor of citizen initiatives say, it's so darn difficult already. So, okay, you know what? We are out of time officially, but you want to take a minute or two, just sum things up about how you felt the legislature went this time?
Again, I thought it went well overall, just a couple bumps because there was so many new people. And that wasn't a bad bump, just a matter of inexperience sometimes. But again, I support the way our system works as far as government through elected representation. It's very, very important to me. And even if I don't agree with you, you have to answer to your constituents, not me. I mean, it's my job to persuade you, but I'm not going to be castigating anybody. And so I respect the fact that people came in and our body looked a little different than it has for the past 8 years that I was there. Still a lot of changes to make, I think, with elections. Representative Sauter and I are trying to make it so people don't feel intimidated when they go to the polls. We had some folks set up outside of the polls here in many of the northern counties, and I received a lot of phone calls about that. And so we want to clean that up a little bit, because as we want people to go to the polls, they should feel safe and comfortable going to the polls.
Well, there's going to be tons more going on, but I want to say, Sage Dixon, thanks for being here with us today. And we will circle back before the next session starts and get your input from you on
Great.
That.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Bye now.